Nevada, serving there for more than 30 years. And in the year 2002, he won the Democratic nomination for the governor of Nevada. He lost, but with a deepening crisis, there are many people now who wish he had won. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Joe Neal from Nevada.
The question on the minds of some of you as to why a fellow from Nevada would be here in the state of California dealing with deregulation. Well, this particular issue is not a parochial one. It's national in scope. Way California goes, there goes the nation. And so we have to be cognizant of that fact and try to meet this threat, whatever we find it, and here in the state of California with your recall and other things that's going on in this state, I felt that it was necessary for me to come over and lend some of my experience to this particular issue and an attempt to defeat it. I have been working this issue for quite some time. As Holly has indicated to you, we had this in the state of Nevada. We were successful and rolling it back, but not completely, because this issue started on a national level in the passage of deregulation of the wholesale of energy in 1992 by the Oman Bush administration. That law is still effective, and we still have those individuals who are selling energy as commodities throughout the country. But I have been successful in this operation through the help of the Shelley Institute and the man who was running for the presidency in 2004, Lyndon LaRouche, who have aided me in many ways to be successful in trying to defeat deregulation in our state, and also educated me on some of the nuances that I did not know that encompass this particular issue as a whole. As some of you know in reading your ERR and your Federalist magazines, that I have appeared in many places in this country, in the state of California, and also in the Midwest, and also have gone to Mexico, in terms of trying to deal with this particular issue. I was invited there through the assistant of the Shelley Institute and Lyndon LaRouche to go to Mexico to try to defeat Enron, which was trying to privatize the energy resources in that particular country. We were very successful in rolling that back. In fact, the 3 days that I was in Mexico and the third day with Holly, and I remember getting on a plane and coming back, and the day I read in the newspaper that we had an earthquake in that the great city of Mexico and Mexico City. And I kind of thought that maybe this was a good omen, because we had done our job, and 2 weeks later they defeated the privatization and deregulation of the energy resources of that particular country. And with the assistance of Lynn, who also participated with us through the use of telecommunication. And I remember listening to him and the influence that he had upon the people that was in attendance at the meeting that we had been involved in. So I'm not going to dwell on too much about myself here. You have read a lot about me and in your ERR and your Federalist Papers. So I'm going to introduce the gentleman that I think that is the savior for this particular country, and who has spoken the truth as to what is going on economically. And I think that we need this individual as our president of the United States in 2004. So I give you Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to talk about the subject of constitutional law from a very specific standpoint, and dealing with the state of California to illustrate a problem of our nation and a problem of the world at large. Recently, the governor of California, Gray Davis, stated that he knew that in the matter of deregulation, he had committed errors. He did not add, as he should have, that practically everyone else, at least not on that occasion, that everyone else in the legislative process who had pushed through deregulation in California had voted the same way, whether Republicans or Democrats. So Gray Davis was not guilty of anything that every representative was not guilty of, either by participation or by negligence. And negligence is also a way of voting. You don't vote and you get what you don't vote for. That's a danger here in California right now. If you don't vote against recall, you may not have a state to vote for the next time around. Now, this involves two levels. On the level, you have the mistake that was made by many people, including the present governor, in adopting and tolerating deregulation. That was a mistake. It was a mistake based on bad judgment, poorly informed judgment. But it was not an intent to commit a crime. They were sold on the idea that deregulation was somehow might be good for the country. And since it was also seemed to be popular in political parties, they better go along with it. Because if it wasn't bad for the country and it was popular, then the popular will must prevail. And they went along with it. And there's been great suffering as a result of it. Then there came a point in which, by some mysterious process, the dumbest man in America, George W. Bush, was seated as president. They asked, offered him a chance to choose between muscles and brains, and guess what he chose? In any case, this brought us in something a little worse than George Bush. And George Bush is not a good person. He's essentially a bad person, mean-spirited. Seems not to have recovered from the full effects of three problems: cocaine, abuse of alcohol, and being raised by the Bush family. But he's a dummy. I mean, he makes Mortimer Snerd look like a genius. So we can't blame him for too much for intention. How can you blame a man for an intention who doesn't know where he is or what he's doing? But there are some who may not be too smart, but are a bit too clever, and whose intentions are very clear. Such a creature is Vice President Cheney. He's admittedly qualified at vice. I guess many people were fooled into assuming he was therefore qualified for that office. We came into the picture early. Now, Cheney is a thief by disposition. He's a thug and a thief. Back in days of high school, back in Wyoming, where he was raised among the cattle, he had a girlfriend, his wife Lynn, and he's sort of her dog, and always has been since back there in high school days, where he'd sit there like a scowling jock, not too bright, not too articulate, knows better than to talk because people hear how stupid he is. And she's out there, the queen of the campus, so forth, goes on to Chicago University, becomes educated by the top fascists in America, and portrays that role today, and she's his dog, he's her dog, and he runs an office. So he has the qualities of a pirate or a thief. And, for example, when he went into the first Bush administration, so-called 41, he was Secretary of Defense. Now, his particular thing, shall we say, was at that time, remember, the Soviet Union was disappearing, and there were those, not only in the Republican Party, but elsewhere around the world, who thought that the dissolution of the Soviet Union meant that the United States was the only superpower in the world, and therefore, why shouldn't we become an empire? Why shouldn't the rest of the world simply be our slaves? And they moved in that direction. Older George Bush was, under advice, a little bit more cautious. Cheney was more on the enthusiastic side. Real jock. So he had two things. First of all, he was pushing a policy of preventive nuclear war as a policy of the United States. A policy whose object was to bring about the establishment of an empire which would be run by the United States, and the United States would be run by people of his persuasion. At that point, the older Bush's administration declined to go along with Cheney. So Cheney's demand for an extended Iraq war at that time, his plans for the development of a new arsenal of nuclear weapons to conduct preventive nuclear warfare against many nations, including those which had no such weaponry, those which had no capable military threat against the United States. He would go to war. He was restrained. Then we got Clinton, and there's that Cheney. And Cheney and his crowd, the crew with him, continued with this project. In 1996, they drafted a document for the worst fascist in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, presumably for Netanyahu government of Israel. It was called, the next step. And this thing was read by Netanyahu to the Congress a few days after it was presented by this crew, Richard Perlman Company, with the Cheney acts in question. It sat there. It was the policy of the right-wing government in Israel, but it was not the policy of the United States. It has sat there. George W. Bush was inaugurated, and it sat there. At that point, the time that George Bush was about to be inaugurated, for reasons which remain obscure to both the voters and the Constitution, I gave a public address of some significance in which I've been involved in this actively in this mess of November 7th, 2000, the 2000 election, which had been an indecision. We had not a constitutional crisis at that time, we had an election crisis, particularly in the state of Florida. Now, this election crisis, whatever they say, was largely created by the Democratic Party, which under the leadership of Al Gore and people like that had gone dumb. So in the state of Florida, they had a law on absentee ballots. The Republicans did their homework on this law and prepared for the election and got their absentee ballots through. The Democrats were a bunch of lazy bums. They didn't do their homework, and they were sitting not knowing competently what to do on the absentee ballots. And they actually won. The Republicans actually won in the state. And the worst of it, that Al Gore, if he had been anybody but Al Gore, would have not bothered with Florida, because all he needed at that point was the Electoral College vote of Arkansas. With the Electoral vote of Arkansas, he was in, dragging that piece of filth with him, Joe Lieberman. That with a cat dragged in, sort of. No, he didn't. He didn't go into Arkansas because Arkansas had been my state, where I got the number of votes that the Gore people stole from me, or from the Electoral College, that year. So they ignored Arkansas, which they had a quarrel with. And they went on to the great and glorious state of Florida, where Gerald Lieberman, whose connections are with a right-wing Cuban, people who kill people and push drugs and do wonderful things like that, and who robs Indians through these Indian operations, Gerald Lieberman thought he had a lot of pull with the right wing in the state of Florida, especially these Cubans. And therefore he thought he said he could carry the state. Well, guess what he carried? He carried George Bush into the White House. In any case, so this was the situation. So under those circumstances, there was great confusion about what to do about the hung-up election of 2000. And I became very actively involved in that issue by various media events and so forth during that period, up into the first part of January 2003. And I had some influence. A lot of people were persuaded that I was right and persuaded we ought to go in that way, but it didn't work out that way. And so George Bush was about to be inaugurated as president. So I gave a forecast of what we faced under a George W. Bush presidency. And there were two points in particular which I emphasized. That the U.S. economy and the world were already being plunged into one of the greatest monetary financial crises in known history. Something which is coming on now. Some of you may have been acquainted with that gentleman as he walked around the streets and neighborhoods of the country. Poverty, depression. And since George Bush was very dumb, when I says what I said, I tend to speak like that. I refer to this man as being dumb. Don't accuse him of being these other things that he doesn't know what he's doing. But he is dumb, and he's very serious about being dumb and mean. So that under those conditions, I forecast that we should expect in the early period of a George Bush administration that the depression, which was already coming on since the spring of 2000, would tend to hit with fuller force in the coming 2 years. Well, it did. That at the same time, under these conditions in the world, I said we must expect what happened in Germany in 1933 as a threat for the period now. This is in January 2001. I referred to the situation in Germany in 1933 when a certain interest, including some people in the United States and Britain, had financed the Nazi Party to come out of bankruptcy to prepare for Hitler's being put in power. And these people who financed Hitler in that way, both in London and in New York, put him into power through a consortium which staged a two-stage coup d'etat in January and February of 1933, at a time that Franklin Roosevelt was already elected but not yet inaugurated. And the government of Germany at that time, under Kurt von Schleicher, was committed in part, at least, to a policy very much like that which Franklin Roosevelt was to implement in March of 1933. And it was well known what Franklin Roosevelt intended to do in March of 1933. So that if nothing had happened and Kurt von Schleicher had been the Chancellor of Germany in March 1933, the United States and Germany would have been on the same general road toward world economic recovery. A hard road, but a successful road. To prevent that, Hitler was put into power. But he was still a fool, sort of almost like a Arnie Schwarzenegger of his time. He was a nothing, dumped into a high office in Germany. People laughed at him. He will be out in the next election, the next crisis, the parliamentary crisis. Why wasn't he out? Why did the fool become a dictator? Because Hermann Göring, in February of that year, shortly less than a month after the inauguration of Hitler on January 30th, 1933, Hermann Göring set fire to the Reichstag. Hermann Göring was the most financially connected member of the Nazi machine. And he was also the head of government of the German state of Brandenburg at the time. So he, as he bragged about this on various occasions later, I did the Reichstag's fire. He set fire to the parliament of Germany, the national parliament in Berlin. No one was in it at the time, except presumably some poor fool called von der Lubbe, who was later indicted and convicted. But the destruction of the institution resulted in the invocation of the doctrine of law of a fellow called Carl Schmitt, who became known as the crown jurist of the Nazi system. Carl Schmitt, of course, is the same fellow who sponsored the career in the United States of a fellow who could not get into the Nazi party because he happened to be Jewish. So this Nazi, Carl Schmitt, sent Leo Strauss by way of England into the United States, where he ended up at Chicago University as Professor Leo Strauss and was the chief breeder of this nest working around Cheney today, called the neoconservatives. The point being, what I was afraid of, something like September 11th, 2001, would happen in the United States by agencies within high positions in the U.S. government. And that is exactly what happened. And that has been used as hype ever since to say some Arabs or so forth. The idea of having a war with Islam was already the policy of Cheney and company before this happened. They were seeking a pretext, and who knows how the what so-called evidence was cooked up in order to create that impression. So at the same time, Cheney intervened into the state of California in the case of Williams Power and similar cases, Enron cases. Remember, Enron was the largest contributor to the Bush campaign of the year 2000. That Williams and these other companies were the same type. They all belonged to the same general breed of cat. Oh, the it had been a collapse of the power system of California in the summer of 2000. This collapse was a result of a breakdown in the system, mechanical system, of the production and distribution of power as a result of deregulation. Chaos would be introduced. I'll get back to this later in the report here. But Cheney moved in once Bush was president to play a key role in orchestrating the way deregulation hit a number of areas of the United States, including especially California. California was the prize. It had the biggest possible potential loot for the crowd around Enron was the state of California. So what you have today is you have the state of California has been looted by this operation to the tunes of tens of billions of dollars that we can trace, apart from the implicit losses of the state by this looting. The key person who did this, partly by his influence in suppressing a report which would expose what was going on in the Williams case, by suppressing that report, the thing became worse in California. And that was the worst period of this power crisis in California. That is what essentially, combined with the collapse of the IT industry and with the real estate mortgage-based securities bubble in California, were the key factors in the collapse of the California economy from a notoriously rich state by comparison with other states into a notoriously impoverished one or bankrupt one. And this was done by courtesy of Dick Cheney and company. We are now living on the edge of dictatorship. The Patriot Act was all a step toward dictatorship. Is it modeled on the Nazi laws? Introduced under a Leo Strauss protege, John Ashcroft. Huh? Who was trained in the tradition of Carl Schmitt's law through Chicago University. in the Strauss circles. We're headed toward fascism in the United States now. The Patriot Act is a step in that, and it's worse. We are also, in a sense, because of what Cheney is doing and what others are doing, with this doctrine that prevented nuclear war, with this axis of evil list which was promulgated in January of 2002, we're headed for, somewhere down the line, for a new world war. Not the kind of world war which Dick Cheney imagines might happen, but a different kind. It's a land war in Asia, or a land war with nuclear and aerial complications in Asia, in which the existing triad, the nuclear triad, on which U.S. power is based, it certainly is not based on our troops, as Iraq shows us, but a nuclear triad of power, the use of nuclear weapons delivered by air or by stratosphere, by submarines, large nuclear submarines, by carrier-based methods, to dominate the world through sheer terror of nuclear weapons. That weapon is not invincible militarily. And other nations which have some power know it and have the capability of developing weapon systems and modes of warfare which are asymmetric with respect to the U.S. capability. They are prepared now, on the basis of the behavior of the Bush administration, especially under the Rumsfeld-Cheney operation. These nations are preparing to fight such a war, an asymmetric nuclear war, during a period corresponding to the next administration of the President of the United States. That does not mean they're committed to a war. That means they are committed not to submit to the kind of preventive nuclear warfare which Cheney represents. That's what we face. We also, in the meantime, face a world depression, a world monetary financial collapse, unprecedented in modern history. The system is bankrupt. People who are talking about a recovery must be Dracula. And only the suckers would join that too. So that's the situation in general we face. So now we look at a situation. On the one hand, we have American people who behave foolishly. We have Gray Davis, who admits that he made a mistake, and he should speak also for all the other legislators who voted for this abomination, or who abstained from voting either way on the abomination. They all made a mistake. The citizens who voted supported them made a mistake. Those who thought deregulation was good made a mistake. A very painful mistake, and they are to blame for their mistakes. They're not criminals because they made a mistake, but they are to accept the blame for their mistakes, not in order to shoulder blame, but in order not to make the same mistake or similar one next time, to learn the lesson of admitting we made a mistake. The Democratic Party made a mistake. The voters, the majority of the voters of California made a mistake. The elected officials of California made a mistake. This mistake is painful. It's costly. It's life-threatening. All right, that's one side. But having known that this is a mistake, what do we say of people who now come back from high positions, who are the profiteers and racketeers who've been looting this state of tens of billions of dollars through deregulation alone, such as Dick Cheney? What do we say of Dick Cheney as the thief? Let's go back again to the 1991-1992 period of Cheney's reign as Secretary of Defense. His gimmick in those days, apart from preventive nuclear warfare and similar kinds of fine enterprises, was privatizing the U.S. military. That is to look over the entire military establishment of the United States and look for various functions of the military which could be performed as for-profit civilian operations. Now, in this connection, he cultivated a relationship with a corporation called Halliburton, for which he gets this $1 million pension. Now, And he built up Halliburton. The privatization of the U.S. military went apace, even under Clinton, as a continuation of this process. We see the mess now in Iraq. Actually, the place has been turned over to some soldiers who really are not equipped or led to deal with the situation there. But for the profit of whom? Normally for the profit of the two large corporations which specialize in this privatized version of military operations. The civilian form of military operations now privatized. Bechtel of the George Shultz, who pulled together the neoconservative apparatus of the present Bush administration. Second, Dick Cheney of Halliburton. Halliburton and Bechtel. Now a problem has arisen. Bechtel is not getting its share of the government payoffs and bailouts. So there's a little conflict between the two allied thieves, like two pirates quarreling over the spoil. Now the President of the United States, poor, sanctimonious, stupid George, goes before the TV the cameras, with his fat face hanging out, and not much behind it, saying, we need $87 billion right now. For what? Guess what? Chiefly Halliburton. Halliburton needs money. So we can shut down our schools, we can shut down our health care, we can shut down this, we can shut down that, and we can do another tax reduction. And pay out $87 billion largely to Halliburton, and call that a patriotic memory of the dead in New York City of September 11th, 2001. And that is the parade that's going on today on the television set in New York and in Washington. A parade of gloating. They died. Now we're going to get revenge. We're going to give $87 billion to Halliburton and company out of the U.S. Treasury. That's what this, the operation is. This is not a mistake. This is something else. It's something closer to the forces behind Adolf Hitler, which I've dealt with a great deal. Now let's look at the other side of the thing. What happened to the American people? Where were they when all these things were happening? I have a certain advantage. There's two advantages, complementary. I have a certain age and experience. I also have, unlike some people my age, a certain kind of vitality and also a determination to do things and some skills as well. Therefore, I can tell you things firsthand as an insider into age group and who do also know these things. Some of them aren't in such good physical condition these days. Former senators, former dignitaries of our country who understand some of these things. But I can tell you what's wrong with the American people because I was there. I experienced it from the 1920s as a child and a young person. The 1930s as an adolescent. I experienced going into World War II. I experienced it coming out of World War II. Each of the steps we've gone through as a people during this period, I have personally experienced. And I can tell you what happened. When I was a child, we were terrible. The people of the United States were terrible. You have no idea how bad they were. Or at least so I thought, until I saw what came along in the 1960s and 70s. They were wastrels. This was the Coolidge era, the flapper generation. They were referred to as the fast people. They burned themselves out fast. You have some famous novels from that period which pertain to this kind of thing. They were disgusting, and I thought so at the time. I was a child, but I knew they were disgusting. I also knew my parents, like most people, honestly lied most of the time, especially when speaking to neighbors and friends. They'd invite the friends or the neighbors in for company. Yeah? They'd talk delightfully, lie to each other pleasantly throughout the whole proceeding. And once the neighbors, the visitors were out the door, my parents would start to gossip about the people they just had received. Typical American behavior. Typical American hospitality. Frankness. Sincerity. I saw the same characteristics in my fellow students of my age group. I saw the same thing in the schools I attended. The same things in the officials I observed. I saw this in the pulpit. They were the worst. Then we went through a terrible time. We went through the onslaught of the Depression, and you have to think from late 1928 until 1932, the income of the United States, that is the physical income, in an estimated rate, dropped to half of what it had been 5 years earlier. Half. Now this meant for many people absolute destitution. In the northern states in the cold winter of 1982-83, many people who had been dignified citizens with houses and jobs and so forth died, froze to death along railroad sidings where they'd taken up habitation in hobo jungles. This was typical of what had happened. We had Hoovervilles in lower New York City, cardboard packing crates in which people were living on the streets. And then Roosevelt came in with a commitment to what he called the forgotten man. This was the theme of his campaign address he gave in Virginia, West Virginia, that time. Roosevelt was well prepared. He was prepared by ancestry. One of his ancestors, Isaac Roosevelt, one who he particularly honored, and you can find in the Hyde Park House, which is now a museum, of the portrait of Isaac Roosevelt hanging there. Isaac Roosevelt was a New York banker who was allied with Alexander Hamilton to defend the United States at that time against things like Aaron Burr, who was a traitor to the United States and who did a great deal to set up the kind of bad practices we have in the United States today. Roosevelt, in his dissertation that he wrote as a Harvard graduate, referred to the American tradition of Hamilton and his ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt. He understood it well. As he had poliomyelitis, was incarcerated, very severely crippled in bed as an adult victim of poliomyelitis, he fought his way back with the help of his wife. And during the years of fighting his way back to functional health, he did extensive study in American history to illuminate what he already knew about his own ancestry and the history of the United States. He became the governor of New York twice, and under conditions of crisis, became the president. And he walked into the presidency about as prepared as anyone could be under such circumstances. He led this nation with all the difficulties and shortfalls imposed upon him and inherent in his assembly of government forces, and led the nation on the road to recovery. And then one day, I didn't know it at the time, but I knew about this sort of thing at the time. Franklin Roosevelt had a discussion with then the Defense Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain, Winston Churchill. And it was a moment where the German troops were being held back temporarily at Dunkirk for a very nasty reason. If the English Expeditionary Force, British Expeditionary Force, which was largely concentrated then at Dunkirk, were to fall into German hands, then England would be stripped of all power. And there were people in England, like Lord Halifax, the Beaverbrook circles, who liked Hitler. And these people were prepared to bring the British Empire in and the French nation and its imperial assets and the fascist nation of Spain and the fascist nation of Italy and the fascists of Belgium and the fascists of Romania into a grand alliance which included a naval alliance of the forces of Japan, which was a partner in this, the forces of the great British Navy, the forces of the Italian Navy, the German Navy, and the French Navy, into a force which, after the destruction of the Soviet Union, which they thought would be short work, they would take on, attack, and destroy the United States. This group was called the Seneca's. I'm not going to go into much on them today as such, because that's a whole subject in itself. But it's the same problem we face today, and it's what Cheney represents today, the same thing. So we're not dealing with mistakes, we're dealing with evil. And on that basis, Churchill and Roosevelt did not agree on much of anything. But they knew that if they could mobilize the patriotic forces of the United Kingdom and the United States around the idea of stopping a takeover of the world by Adolf Hitler, they could save the world from that horror which a Hitler takeover would represent. And they succeeded. But then Roosevelt became ill and died. He became very ill the time he was running for his fourth term of re-election, summer of 44. And those people who had been Hitler sympathizers before 1940, in the United Kingdom, in the United States, and in France, among other places, turned the other way. They went back to getting rid of Franklin Roosevelt, knowing that he was about to die of the complications arising from poliomyelitis and the strain he put upon his system as a result of his labors as president, particularly under the wartime conditions. So they put in Harry Truman as the vice president, a man who was skilled at vice. Now, the importance of this is what most of you thought, probably, that Truman was a good Democrat, be disabused. The reason that we voted for Eisenhower, I didn't happen to vote for Eisenhower. I was prepared to vote for him in 1947 when I had a correspondence with him on this subject. We who returned from the war found the following facts. First of all, we had been betrayed, implicitly betrayed. Everything that Roosevelt had promised about the post-war world had been betrayed. Roosevelt promised a post-war world based on American supremacy, in fact. Nobody could say no to it, saying the colonial system would be eliminated, and we would establish a world of sovereign nation states as a community of principle. No more colonialism. Truman put the colonial power back in. Truman, with no necessity for doing so, dropped two nuclear weapons on the civilian populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Truman and his friends staged the firebombing of cities of Germany for no military purpose. They actually prolonged the war by so doing. What we found back in the United States, those who had gone off to war and come back with the anticipation of a better world as a result of having defeated Hitler, found we were living under a kind of fascistic mood in the United States itself. This was accelerated quickly by the so-called Cold War, the Churchill Iron Curtain speech. We went into a kind of dictatorial mood like that that you have from Ashcroft after September 11, 2001. Patriotic Act kind of tyranny. People afraid. Now, during the period from 1945 into the Eisenhower election, the people of the United States were increasingly afraid. They call it McCarthyism today. To understand the truth of it, you call it Trumanism. And people became cowards. Said, keep your mouth shut. Don't get into trouble. Don't get our family into trouble. Say what they expect you to say. Don't say what you think. Watch out. You'll lose your job. Something will happen to you. They turn the generation which returned from war, my generation, largely into cowards. I saw it. I experienced it. Many of these people were my friends. I watched the process in them individually as well as collectively. Now, these people who returned from war with me, many of them moved out of the suburbia or other things, and they raised families. They were in a rush to build up a family lifestyle after 5 years or so away at war. Wives especially were pushing. We've got to get our family established. We've got to get a house. We've got to start the children now. We've got to find a better place to live. You've got to better get a job. Get a white-collar job. Get a white-collar job. Move into suburbia. And they did. And they caught their children. Be careful. Be careful. Be careful. Don't say what you think. The neighbors are watching. Lie. Stick to popular opinion. Don't express your own views. Don't think. It'll get you into trouble. So we had a generation that came into that. So after the shock of the war and the Hitler period, this shock hit the returning veterans of World War II. And they began to raise children to whom was transmitted this impulse for cowardice, moral cowardice, which you see is characteristic of the U.S. population today. Now these children come along, they like the civil rights movement, they like these kinds of things, many of them. They seem to be the beautiful children. But then, 1961, Bay of Pigs. The fascists are back at it again. Alan Dulles is fascist. 1962, Russell and Company organized what became known as the Missile Crisis. 1962, and everybody, or nearly everybody, I felt like a person standing in the street, with a deserted street, with everybody hiding in holes. Nearly everybody, in a few days period, of the height of the nuclear missile crisis of 1962, was terrified, as they had never been before, because all this period had the buildup of how bad nuclear warfare would be. You had these so-called science fiction movies telling you how bad nuclear warfare would be. The ants would suddenly grow large and eat you all because of nuclear radiation, things like this. They were terrified. Then came the assassination of John Kennedy. The terror increased. Then came a useless war in Indochina. Again, completely incompetent, immoral. MacArthur warned Kennedy personally, don't get into a land war in Asia, which is what Cheney and Rumsfeld and so forth are trying to do today. Don't get involved in a land war in Asia. You won't come back, at least not in the same form you went. So the war, a younger generation with whom some of you may be acquainted, who are coming into adulthood, decided they didn't like what we had been up to that time. Up to that time, we had been a producer society. We were the most productive nation on the planet. You could even find remains and traces of those industries around Southern California that used to exist here, where people could make a decent living and jobs with dignity to them and not fake their way out around it. We were the production machine of the world. We took pride in the fact that we were useful. We made things. We made better things. We made it possible for other nations to have better things, to have a higher standard of living. We had the objective for our own people. We had the objective for our own children, that they would have that something better than we had. Through our power to produce, our power to increase our power to produce, our power to solve problems, our power to be human. That went away. Because these young people would suddenly have this feeling of betrayal. Producer society had betrayed them. And all the witch doctors came along to tell them, oh, you're right, you're so right. You're consuming too much. Consumer society, producer society, Blue shirts are bad. White shirts are not so good either. Go shirtless. Go naked. Huh? You want pleasure? Take it from your neighbor. And then acquire what sex they are afterward. As long as you have the pleasure. So we became a post-industrial culture. We became increasingly that. We became a consumer society. We lost ourselves at that point about 40 years ago. Then we had the change in the monetary system, in which we became a predator nation by the floating exchange rate system set up in 1971-72. We had the ability with the British to control the value of the currency of every country on this planet. All we had to do was rig a raid on a currency against some national currency, then go in and say, oh, you went out, call in the IMF, call in the World Bank. They'll advise you on what to do. The advice was lower the value of your currency, put on sharp austerity to pay your debts, and accept an increase, fictitious debt, which is imposed upon you to compensate your creditors for the devaluation of your currency. Ibero-America, Central and South America, has more than paid, many times over, everything that was ever owed to the United States or other countries since 1971. In point of fact, morally, by strict, honest accounting, the nations of Central and South America owe not a penny in foreign debt. This includes Argentina. Not a penny. It was all a big swindle. But the big swindle was important, because we got the poor nations of the world to become even poorer and to work harder for us, to produce things for us. We shut down our factories. We didn't produce anymore. We became an unproductive, post-productive, which lived as a predator nation by having the financial power to compel the rest of the world to work for us cheap for whatever we wanted. And we got cheap stuff, believe me. Go into a mall and see what you could find in the mall. That bunch of rags would make old rags look blush in shame. All right. So that's what we did to ourselves. So in this era, the idea that we're going into a post-industrial society, no more big infrastructure, no more big government, and all of these things we depended upon, we destroyed or allowed to be destroyed increasingly, especially in the past 30-odd years. And here we are today. So our people developed under the impact of fear, successive fear from generation to generation. Fear because of the World War I or World War II and what came out of it, the nuclear age. Fear of a long fear of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Fear heightened by the experience of 1962-63. Fear now heightened by a new terror. The terror is so-called myth of September 11th, 2001. We've got a bunch of scared people out there. If they're irrational, you have to understand why they're irrational. And to take the role of leadership that I must take, and others I hope would take, you have to understand your own people. You don't go out and say to them, I represent popular opinion. I tell you, popular opinion stinks. I was there when it was born. My job is to try to save the people from their own opinions or the consequences of those opinions, not by imposing opinions upon them, but by getting them to recognize themselves the error of those opinions and thus become stronger, more accurate, less susceptible to error, because they have used their own minds to be able to understand these kinds of problems. Like understanding economics, for example. Most of you guys don't know anything about economics. And you, compared with the guys outside the room, are geniuses. It anybody that can vote for deregulation, obviously, there's something wrong with them. All right, so therefore, the problem in politics is a problem of leadership. Because even though we're all human, many of us have not yet been able to live up to what it is to be human. We don't have a true sense of immortality. We don't have a sense that our life, which is always mortal, it's going to end, you know, in every case. We can't escape that. We can maybe postpone it, but we can't prevent it. The question is, therefore, what does your life mean? Now, if you're convinced that your life means something because you are taking something from the past, which you've been given, you're transmitting it as culture to the future, you're adding something to this store of what you give, then you know, just as you know the value of Archimedes' contributions to you from, you know, over 2,000 years ago, or others, or the work of Plato, others. You recognize the work of people before you as individuals whose ideas you can replicate, as in any proper school, ideas you can replicate. You know that you are experiencing their discoveries, discoveries which only a human being could make. No monkey could make it. No George Bush is likely to make it. You know that you're experiencing this. You know that you can use this to the human benefit, this knowledge. You know that you can transmit this knowledge or assist in transmitting it to coming generations. And you know that you, in a sense, live for the human species in thousands of years to come, even after you're deceased. Because what you represent does not die, provided that we organize society to ensure that the great gifts which are transmitted to us and given to us by individuals shall not be allowed to die. They shall live, and the names of those who gave them shall be honored as much as we are capable of doing for all time to come. Now, it's that kind of courage which enables a soldier to fight war as a man and not as a beast. People can fight war as beasts. They often do it. To kill the enemy, somebody you hate, you go out and you kill him. When you fight war, in this kind of war which is sometimes imposed on us as civilized nations, we fight war for the objective of achieving peace. The peace we achieve will be based on the people of our own people and the people of the opposing nations, the resources and institutions we rescue as the end of war. We then are devoted to using these things that survive the war as the instruments of building a better peace than before the war in which we had just entered. This was the famous principle of modern civilization set out in 1648 under the initiative of a great diplomat, Cardinal Jules Mazarin of France, called the Treaty of Westphalia. The purpose of peace among nations is each nation must think in terms of the advantage of the other. You must think of what we do, which is useful for other nations. And this is easy in the sense of me, from the standpoint of the United States, because I'm proud of the history of our nation and what it represents. I'm proud of what Benjamin Franklin represents, of what Winthrop represents from the 17th century in the colonization, what Cotton Mather represents, of the influence of Leibniz on our formation of the ideas of Franklin. Franklin's role as the man who created a youth movement, which became the government of the United States. And of those great leaders we've had who stood out among many bums, but who great leaders who have, like Lincoln and like Roosevelt, who have contributed to mankind. And if you think like that, and you think about your nation is as important as it is to the world, which means as important as the benefit of your existence as a nation is to the world around you. And if your role as a leader of a nation is the benefit you represent not to yourself, but to your people, and through your people, to the other people of the world, then you have a sense of being able to do anything that's necessary. You're not afraid to die. You don't seek to die, but you're not afraid to die because you know your life means something, and they can't cheat you of the meaning of your life. If you achieve that, and it is my purpose and has been the purpose of every leader that is respectable of our nation and our civilization to do that, to somehow aid society in discovering that as the natural condition of man within society. This is the true meaning of general welfare, of the term general welfare, as traced from the term agape in the Greek of Plato, or in the 1 Corinthians 13, where the same term is used by, in the Greek, is by, used by the Apostle Paul, agape. That you live for the others. You are a necessary being. You are a necessary person who is going to contribute something to society. And you live for the others. And if they wish to succeed as you try to succeed, they will try to do the same. The function of government, of constitutional government, in our way of thinking as Americans, of a melting pot nation, our Constitution, as in the preamble of the Constitution, is based on these principles: the sovereignty of our people and its institutions, the obligation of government to promote the general welfare, and the obligation of the citizens to participate with government in promoting the general welfare. That is agape. The commitment above all to posterity, to do such things with our life as will be also beneficial to those who come after us. That's the purpose of true constitutional government. Let me just turn for a final note on the question of economics, on the question as it applies to infrastructure. This egoistical thinking, which says, I earn this. Well, buddy, you don't earn anything. If I put you with all your skills on a deserted island with nothing at hand, what are you going to produce? And we're talking about California. The effects of deregulation. Remember how we organized this many times in our national history, and especially under Roosevelt, who took us out of the debris of the Coolidge and Hoover era, which was really immoral. Hoover was not incompetent in any respect, but he was not morally very good. We set up regulation. Now, regulation is very simple. Let's take something called power. I think you know something about power. You know the price of power impresses you? The reliability of power, or lack of it thereof, impresses you? The price of water, the availability of it, impresses you. Sinking aquifers impress you. Or they, at least they depress the land. And maybe you too. Places where you used to have rich agriculture, which is now dying, or rich forestation, which is now dying, because of lack of management of water and other things. You say, well, production depends on what? Production depends upon society preparing the ground in which the producers live and work. For example, take the case of power. The productivity of labor depends upon the power available, efficiently available to people in that area and to that particular enterprise in particular. Power available. Now, the measure of power is not in watts. The measure of power is in what we call, it's actually in energy flux density is a better approximation. That is, energy sources of higher intensity, such as the transition from burning fuels to petroleum to nuclear power to thermonuclear fusion, are each higher degrees of power. And the quality of the power which you're able to generate by these and related means is the means by which labor is transformed in its ability to produce. One of the aspects. Even with the greatest genius, without adequate power, cannot produce a successful society. So therefore, we, recognizing that in the United States, recognize that there's a certain aspect which could not be left of the economy, could not be left to private interest as such. Because these are things that pertain to all the people. Who is responsible for all of the people? The government. Who is responsible for all of the land? The government. For the development of all the land. Who is responsible for the conditions of production which are needed in society? The government. Who is responsible for health care? The government. The doctors may provide it, but the government must provide the conditions under which the doctors can function. And to be more important than either health care is sanitation. And government must provide the chief source of sanitation. So therefore, the degree to which this is available is significant. Take another case, transportation. Now, Los Angeles used to have a mass transit system. What do you got now? Traffic jams. You ever see a traffic jam? Ever had trouble? Now, what are you doing in a traffic jam? You're wasting your life. You're sitting there becoming angry, probably turning into a beast slowly. Enraged. Sitting in a traffic jam means less time with your family. It means family life is disrupted characteristically in areas which are dominated by traffic jams. And if you understand what family life should be, the idea of the family table, at least the evening table, is very important in a family. The sense of family caring is extremely important. Therefore, we must be concerned not with what people get paid at their job alone. We have to be concerned about what conditions of life do they have when they get home. What are the conditions of life in the school? Do they have schools near the neighborhood? Do they have a community which will tend to care for children? You used to have grandparents and neighbors would care for a lot of the children, you know, when there was trouble in the neighborhoods. They cared, and they would help. They weren't always the best neighbors in the world, but they all had this sense of mutual responsibility for helping. And they would help each other. We have problems today we didn't have before, precisely because we fragmented society with these crazy ideas. We have people who transport. How many hours a day do some people travel, commute to and from jobs? How many jobs do they commute to? How many members of the family commute in these kinds of jobs, in these kinds of conditions? What kind of social life is left? What happens then to mass entertainment? What does social life become? What does your human life become? You work? Yeah, that's fine. Preferably you work at something you feel useful at. But what do you become? You think of your children, for example. Maybe not your children, but the next neighbor's children. That is your future. Their children are your future. The grandchildren of any generation are the future of that generation. And those who think about having a meaningful life think about what they are giving to the generation of their grandchildren. If not their own, at least the others. Just the way neighbors would help care for children. If you don't have your own children, well, care about what happens to the others. And think about what you're giving to the next generation. Therefore, if we think about these physical values of adequate power, in the case of power, we say we have to regulate it. The responsibility of production of power is to make sure we have enough power, that we have a system for increasing the amount of power available. We will have the capacity of delivering the quality of power and the amount needed to areas which now come into new needs for applying this to production. We want a high density, a high energy density mode of production. We want to lessen the emphasis on the muscle side of labor and shift the emphasis more and more to the mind. Also in production, not just in thinking about things, but in production. You know, the happy worker in production in the old days when we were still a productive society was the fellow who went from a factory job of a routine type, with a skill or without a skill, who would get into research and development. And you had a guy who was just a regular employee, a skilled employee, in a plant, and he would be upgraded because of his development of his skill, and he showed intelligence and ingenuity, into a better kind of job. He might get more pay, usually would, in research and development. But he got more than pay, better pay. He got the satisfaction of being able to do something creative in a more explicit way on his job, to make better things than existed before, and to play a part in doing that. The excitement, for example, of somebody doing a proof of principle test on some new kind of process. This is a permanent change in the power of mankind to produce things. This fellow has a sense of being personally involved in a very satisfactory way in production. So our job is to produce this kind of society, to produce this environment in which the individual entrepreneur can function as an entrepreneur, usually a small entrepreneur, not a big corporation, but preferably a small entrepreneur, a few hundred employees at most, who are trying to move in that direction, that form of production, that form of product, the quality of product, that quality of service. If the function of government is to provide and ensure what only government can do, that these essential means of infrastructure which are needed to promote those changes in the nature of our society, that those can be made. And for example, now, and just take the one example, the illustrationist point. The key feature of my policy, and what I've done is, it's very important, I think, for California at this time. The second paper, which will be distributed among you in the coming weeks, before the recall comes around, will be a paper which is titled Sovereign States of the Americas. Now, as many of you know, especially in California, the largest minority group in the United States today is the Spanish-speaking minority, or people of Spanish-speaking ancestry. The largest single group. Now that you think of California in those terms, all right, you've got the Spanish-speaking part, which also covers Texas, the border areas, and so forth. Then you take another part, another aspect of California. How about Asian population, Asian immigration? How much of Asia is represented in the population of California? How much of other parts of the world? California is a special kind of melting pot nation. And how we think as a nation, whether as a state or a nation as a whole, is reflected in the way we are able to engage with neighboring countries. The most relevant neighboring country for the United States today, and immediately neighboring, is, of course, Mexico. Mexico has the largest impact of any single area of the world around us upon California. Mexico is in a distressful state. Now that we have this great area, which runs from the Arctic down through the Great American Desert, between the coastal ranges and the Rocky Mountains. The Great American Desert has not been developed, no progress has been made of any net effect since 1910. None. Since Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt stopped development of the Great American Desert in the name of conservation, to conserve the desert. A man with a deserted mind. All right, then you go down into Mexico, across the border, and you find between the branches of the Sierra Madre Mountains, you find another branch of the American Desert, a similar condition in Sonora, in northern Mexico. You find Mexico now, what are we doing in Mexico? We have a problem on the cross-border problem. We have first and second generation Mexican immigrants in the United States who are adapting to the United States, southern states, and large degree California. Then you go across the border. These people are supporting California. Their cheap labor, in large degree, is supporting the state of California. Okay? Now you go on the other side of the border, you got the Maquis Adores. We, in the United States, are forcing Mexico, for its own defense, to employ its people at wages that cannot support a family, physically. We're increasing the death rate in these areas. So therefore, we're looting Mexico directly through the slave labor operations, which are being run in the name of maquiladoras across the border. We are also using a cheap Mexican labor pool inside the United States, especially concentrated in first and second generation immigrants into residency in the United States. Therefore, how we think about ourselves, how we think about the world, is epitomized by the way we think about these people of Spanish extraction, Spanish-speaking extraction, on both sides of the border, especially this particular group. And therefore, what I propose is to indicate the kind of world which the United States should find itself in, a world of a community of sovereign nation states. We have to think in concrete terms, especially in the Americas, We have to think of our relationship as a people to the people of neighboring countries. We have to look, take the advantage that we are a melting pot nation, the most distinctively melting pot nation in our Constitution on this planet. We have no race in this country, except idiots who think they have one. We are a people, one people. We are in the process of developing a similar language culture, a same language culture, which is essential. But we are one people. We are one race, the human race. And therefore, having that character, we at our best, and I saw this in the war, for example, World War II, we at our best, we care for other people, people of other countries. And we practice that, especially in conditions in our own country, where some group in our of our own population is victimized, and where that group corresponds to some foreign nation as a source of extraction. Therefore, I featured this relationship for a programmatic development of this great American desert, to move this water project, which is the old Parsons-Nuapo project, to move that thoroughly down from the Arctic Ocean all the way down to the border of Mexico, southern border of Mexico, where southern Mexico has lots of water at high mountain ranges. To bring this water up, as the Mexicans have planned for a long time, along a canal along the Pacific coast and a canal on the Caribbean coast. And also to move it midway up through the higher range into areas like this area between the two Sierra Madres. If we at the same time build a new railway system of a modern type down into Mexico City, now what we've done is we've created the environment in which the potentiality of production and productive improvement in the whole area increases. The wealth of both sides of the border will increase through this kind of cooperation, while the sovereignty of both nations will be protected. And this is what I'm pushing. We're pushing the same kind of thing in Asia as Eurasian projects. In Africa, the situation is hopeless unless we take power. There's genocide in Africa beyond belief, sub-Saharan Africa. It's deliberate. The United States government is responsible. The British government is responsible. The Israeli government is responsible. These are the three governments most responsible for genocide in Africa. And let So therefore, this is both economics, it's also humanism. And the two things have to be, we produce infrastructure because people need it. It's absolutely also essential for economy. We produce economic relations with other countries based on these human considerations because we need them economically. We produce these conditions because we need it, because we're human. Because we don't want it again, ever again, get in a situation where we find sovereign nations of the world killing each other because somebody's manipulating them over some conflict which is orchestrated. We want a community of principle of nations on this planet. My belief that one thing on this connection, I know the world fairly well, because I'm an inquisitive, nosy person, I guess you could say. I look around at cultures all over the world. I have friends and collaborators in many parts of the world. Being a little bit older, it helps the process. You become more acquainted with more people. I travel a lot, as some of you know, and some complain. But I know Europe. I know it well enough. I know how to pick these things out. An old management consultant, I know how to pick things out fairly quickly. We've dealt with Russia. I have a long-standing relationship with India, going back to World War II times. And I know other parts. In parts of the Arab world, I'm probably the only American that they consider civilized. So I know the world, and I understand the world. The time has come, I'm convinced, that the world is ripe to do what John Quincy Adams, Lincoln intended, and what Roosevelt had hoped to do. The time has come to end this kind of conflict, a Hobbesian world conflict, and to establish on this planet a community of sovereign nation states as a matter of principle. And to make this work by defining groups of economic projects of cooperation, which also have a certain human quality, which elevate the man's sense of man, his nature. We in the United States are the only nation which was created with this mission assigned to it at the point of our creation. We were created by Europe with the idea that we could accomplish this mission. The greatest minds of Europe at that time, especially during the middle to late 18th century, concentrated on the figure of this genius, Benjamin Franklin, who the leading scientists of Europe looked toward as the leader of a new nation in North America, a nation which was intended to become, as Lafayette put it, a beacon of hope and temple of liberty for all mankind. We have that tradition. We have embedded in us, in our national tradition,
So to facilitate the question and answer session, we're going to have a relatively strict procedure. So people who want to ask questions should go to the microphone in the middle of the room and give your name to Carrie, who will make sure that we call on you. It may not be in the order you sign up. I'm going to have some discretion for that. While we're waiting for that, let me mention a couple of things. First, Lynn mentioned the question of his vitality. Let me call to your attention that 3 days ago, Lyndon LaRouche turned 81 years old. Happy birthday, Lyndon.
I'm not sure I did it. I know it happened to me.
Now, secondly, you mentioned friends and collaborators around the world. I'd like to introduce some people here who have come from far parts of the world, members of the LaRouche movement. We have some members of the LaRouche movement from Australia here. Would they please stand? We have a group of people who came here from Mexicali, Mexico, across the border, with whom we'll be working. Would you please stand? Lainey would kill me if I didn't mention that we have someone from the Danish organization here. Now, I have one additional message sent to this gathering from former Senator Eugene McCarthy. His message for California. He said, "I send my best wishes to Lyndon and to this meeting. I am encouraged to see the youth movement taking leadership in organizing the defeat the recall and working to bring about the sort of public happiness the founders knew, celebrated, and expected. I was brooding about the future of the two-party system when I found out that this is no longer considered a problem, since Lady Macbeth and her husband, Vice President Cheney, put on their Phrygian caps and decided that we only need one party. To make this clear and simple for the average voter in California, they brought in a well-known character to terminate any unnecessary elections or parties." He said one thing about a pig and deregulation. This is still Senator McCarthy. He said, "A pig thinks he's warm if his nose is warm." I saw a picture one time of a bunch of pigs that had frozen to death, each one's nose tucked under the rump of the one in front. Lynn, he said, "We have a lot of pigs in politics." This Senator Eugene McCarthy, by the way, was the one who ran in 1968 with a youth movement to bring down the Johnson administration and to create the conditions for the war in Vietnam to be stopped. Unfortunately, that didn't succeed, but this time the youth movement will succeed. One other note before I turn the floor over to you for questions. As I think most of you realize by looking around this room, we have a movement. We have a movement that's been out every single day doing what the Democratic Party of this state should be doing. Taking on that bag of steroids, Arnie Schwarzenegger, and his handlers, the George Shultzes, the Pete Wilsons of Prop 187, the Buffetts and others who Lynn was talking about earlier. To wage this battle, we need some funds. We've printed tens of thousands of bumper stickers which are available, the most popular of which, at least I'm told among the executive committee of the Democratic Party, although I don't think they put it on their Porsches and Mercedes, is the one that says, LaRouche says, one imported Austrian head of state was too much. No on recall. These are available at our literature table outside, along with the first pamphlet, Who Robbed California? We've printed a 500,000 of these already, including 100,000 in Spanish. And we can print as many as another 500,000 more. But it's going to take some funds. So I would encourage people here, as you leave, to see our, go through our literature room, to see our young people, and to contribute to your own future. Not just money, but your time and your efforts. But especially your money. So, Carrie, do you have some questions?
Yes, we're going to start with Cody Jones. But I just want to remind everybody that's asking a question to try to be as brief as possible, because then more people can ask questions. Just makes sense. So if, Cody, you want to start off?
Okay. And if Freddie Coronel will come up here, please.
Hi, Lynn. So my question has to do with the problem in communicating ideas, which is obviously important as organizers. This something came to my head the other day, and I was talking to this kid out of the campus, and he had read some of the literature before, and he was sort of going off, as a lot of people do, saying, well, a lot of this talk about fascism and all this stuff, this is just hyperbole and blah, 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 blah. So I started thinking that perhaps the problem is that people don't really have a real idea behind the words and the language, that they just have some sort of emotional attachment to words like fascism or economy or any of these things, but they don't have no idea has ever been developed for them that these words are representative of. And they also have no sense of history behind these words. So I was just wondering if you could address how we deal with that problem with people, and if you could just discuss in general the idea of the communication of ideas.
The problem is largely that people have been trained not to understand what they're saying when they use words. Actually, what they actually are saying, not what they think they're saying. And people are manipulating words like symbols. We call them symbol-minded people. Now, the point is ideas have passion, especially human ideas. Because passion is the Greek concept of power. The people who connect the dots, you connect this dot to that dot and say that's how you get from dot A to dot B. But you don't get from dot A to dot B by a line. You get from dot A to dot B by an action. And human action is a willful action. It's a choice of principle or application of principle to acting. Huh? So now, if you don't, what moves the planets is, in a sense, gravitation. It's Kepler's conception, right? And that is not a line. The line doesn't move. There's something about that line which is not a line. It's a pathway of change, of constant change, which reveals a hidden principle which is controlling that motion. When we apply, when we understand a universal physical principle and we apply it, we are actually invoking a principle with our mind and using whatever facility we have to express that principle to move something. Now, movement is the definition of emotion. When you see people talking with emotionless tick-a-tap-tape type talk, you know what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a zombie. It's some robot left over from a discarded robot factory. And the problem is when people speak, when they think, when they articulate, they don't communicate ideas. They communicate words, phrases, formulas. There's no passion. No passion. I just was talking the other day about this thing about passion on different contexts. Shakespeare. And about this Hecuba, the second soliloquy of Hamlet, the second act soliloquy. Passion. Hecuba. Passion. Passion. And the problem is the people circulate ideas which you're supposed to respond to on a code and key basis, but there's no passion, there's no meaning behind them. And they think of themselves as animals. They think of themselves as objects of sense perception. Not as sense perception, merely the shadow of the reality. What we call ideas, like the idea of gravitation, is a principle which lies behind the shadows and beyond the shadows of sense perception. When we change the universe by discovering and applying a principle, we're applying something unseen, something which is not symbolizable, cannot be reduced to a symbol, but a universal principle. We are applying that to the universe, and man thereby increases his power over the universe by applying a principle. When you see people speaking, when they don't have passion, real passion, not emotion in the sense of, I'm going to put my fist up or something or other, but passion in the sense of its involvement with ideas. For example, when people recite poetry and there's no passion in it, they don't understand the poetry, if it's classical poetry. And you find that when people speak these days, the way they're educated to speak, you listen to these crazy television sets, what with the rat-a-tat-tat going on there? There's no idea. You don't, you know, when you hear a person of a language you're not familiar with or only partly familiar with, and they're a classical speaker, it's very easy to understand their intention because the way they speak expresses emotion. And therefore you get it. When somebody is a rat-a-tat-tat speaker, it's very difficult to follow their language. There are no clues. There's no passion. And so the extent to which you have an empathy in communication, and the empathy is focused on the equivalence of ideas, whether it's classical ideas of culture or classical principles of physical principles, you have to communicate that. And people don't communicate it. They're uncritical. They say, well, this proves this. People who say, well, I've got a mathematical statistical proof for this or that. That's no proof. They don't know that a statistics does not prove anything. But they believe in statistics. Well, statistics teaches us. That's why you're an idiot. You went to the wrong teacher. So the point is the importance of a classical culture. That's a classical artistic culture, as well as a scientific culture, is without a classical culture, you cannot develop in a people the ability to communicate what famously Shelley described as in times of great enlightenment. There's an increase in the capacity for imparting and receiving profound conceptions respecting man and nature. And poetry was his argument for poetry. Poetry typifies that. Poetical drama. The case of Shakespeare and Schiller typifies that. The function of the great classical literature, the great classical drama, is to enable us to understand history, to understand mankind, by being able to communicate across centuries ideas, to understand Plato, to understand the figure Socrates in Plato's drama, to understand ancient works. How do you understand the ancient Greek classics? How do we understand Shakespeare? How do we understand, say, Schiller today? Without that classical basis as a classical culture in the schools, in social practice, it's impossible to have a sane society, because you cannot communicate ideas. Now, the case you give an example, that type of case. Yes, how would you approach the problem successfully? You have to engage the person and say, now come on, let's cut out the crap. What are you really talking about? You're just mouthing words there. It doesn't mean anything. This is standard sophistry. Sophistry minus 101. So let's talk about what the meaning of these terms are. What do they mean in practice? If you can engage a person and get them to engage in a Socratic dialogue about these things, then you've conquered it. Then you realize from conquering the problem that way in particular instances that you wish you had a culture, a practice culture, which is classical, and which all people would tend to be critical about ideas in the way that classical culture requires. And that's a big subject, but that's as short as I can make it, I guess, right now.
Before we take the next question from the floor, there was a question that was phoned in from an official in the Democratic Party in California who wanted to know, Lynn, what you can say about the assassination of the Swedish foreign minister and the implications of that, given your forecast of chaos.
Okay. You have to look very carefully at this. Now, in the late year 2002, I've reported on this on other occasions, there was an international rallying in Spain of international fascist organizations of a very specific type called the Syndicates International. The organization was assembled around a figure who had been an official of the Franco regime and who was sort of the leading fascist figure of Spain today, this Blas Pinar. The groups that were brought together included groups like the New Right This, the New This, the New Order This, and so forth. These are groups, all sometimes the Compass Plot names. Now, these groups are not just your basic, we discussed yesterday this question of the Freddy principle from Friday the 13th. And you have a lot of people who look at the Hitler image and all the horrible stories from the Hitler image, and they react like fans of Freddy or Jason in the Friday the 13th. They are so impressed and so awed by this figure that they want to emulate it. So these are just fools. They're dangerous fools. They're useful commodities. But that's not the real problem. You've got some real ones, and they come from ancient times. For example, let's take one case. Take the case of Moro, Aldo Moro, the former prime minister of Italy, who was subjected to kidnapping and assassination, at least on the political orders, personally, of Henry Kissinger, who delivered the threat personally to Aldo Moro in a meeting in CIS in Washington, D.C. And the execution was carried out by a Syndicates network in Italy of this type. These people were, the Italian group came out of World War II. These were part of the fascist secret police organization. They were brought into the Gladio organization as this special Gladio operation in the post-war period by the British and American authorities. And they are assets of NATO. Now, these people are the key to most of the serious assassination waves in Europe, say, in the 1970s. The Bologna train station bombing. Right. Now, people of this type, groups that are associated with that type of activity, are being regrouped around the world today. They're being regrouped in South America, where there's a very strong Syndicalist alliance, right-wing Syndicalist alliance and left-wing. I know the history of this thing pretty much like the back of my hand. Now, the danger here, well, we're in a period in which this woman, with all her pluses and minuses. This Anna Lindh, the foreign minister of Sweden, was targeted by syndicate circles. She was killed. I don't know who killed her. I don't know who the assassin is. What I do know is, looking at this from a standpoint of government, as a person who is seeking to assume responsibilities for our government, how do we react to something like this? Do we react by saying, we're going to get the perpetrator and that's everything? We do and we don't. In a case like that, you try to find the perpetrator. You try to solve the mystery. You must. But your policy does not depend upon finding the perpetrator. Your policy says, what is the situation in society which lets something like this loose? And you have to intervene, and when I say intervene now, to recognize the great danger, the greatest danger in every part of the planet to the social order, including things like this, is syndicism. The Syndicates International is alive and unwell in the world today. It's reactivated. It's reactivated for the same reason that what happened in September 11, 2001 happened. The time has come where certain financial interests of the same type that were behind the Jacobin terror, behind Napoleon Bonaparte, behind Napoleon III, behind all kinds of things. But this thing is still there. These interests are still there. These are the people that were behind Hitler back in the 1930s. They're still around. Or the interests, maybe their children or something are around, but they're still around as a force. And they're very active today. And what controls Cheney and the neocons around him are precisely that group. These groups are killers. These are people who use terrorism as a method. It's a big subject because you have to understand what the root of this thing is. Most people talk about terrorism, they don't know what they're talking about. If you're terrified, well, fine, but that's all right. But what is a terrorism of this form? I understand it. Unfortunately, there are a limited number of people in the world who do, because they haven't studied the question. I know it very closely, like the back of my hand. And that is my reaction is, all right, this happened. This woman should not have been running around without security in this department store where she was assaulted. It should not happen. For the foreign minister of a country at this time, no. Every public official of any significance is subject to assassination, and you don't know which it will be. Therefore, my response as a public official would be, we must protect all the people who are in the category of these targets. Take reasonable precautions. There are no such things as perfect precautions, but there are reasonable precautions, and there's unreasonable risk. Every significant figure, public figure, whose death might be a threat to the stability of nations or part of the process, must be protected, must have adequate security. And that means personal security. They watch. They don't go around alone. They're not exposed. The woman's problem, she's walking around. Therefore, she's walking around free without protection. That means she's a free target. Some man comes up behind her with a knife and an axe. He's a capable killer. She's finished. She hasn't got a chance. And if there's security around, then she has a chance. So therefore, the first thing is recognize that security must be upgraded, not the way Ashcroft says, but this way. Simple government taking responsibility for trying to increase the protection with aid of normal law enforcement means. No Patriot Act, no funny business, just normal law enforcement business. We'll find out who the drug dealers are in the neighborhood. That's part of your security problem. Most crime will be committed by criminals. Find out what the criminal community is. If law enforcement is in a routine, competent job of paying attention to crime, especially violent, prone crime, then you've taken care of a lot of the problem. So that's my answer. First of all, more security, but also recognize that the likely suspect in a given number of any such cases is the Syndicates International. Our job now is to expose that thing, what it is, why it is, and get rid of it. It gave us Hitler before. Why don't we get rid of it?
Let me just remind you that we do have in the Executive Intelligence Review the last few weeks a series of reports on this network, the Synarchist International that Lyndon LaRouche was speaking about, and those are available at the as you leave. Now, I'm going to take one more question before I turn it over to Freddie Coronel from the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Los Angeles. I'd like to recognize Ed Asner. Some of you know him from his acting career. I can tell you that in the 1980s, he was the leading thorn in the side to this Bush network when he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild and took on the Iran-Contra network. So, Ed, you have a question? No? No question. Okay, he's just eager to hear. So, Freddie? This is Freddie Coronel from the LaRouche Youth Movement in Los Angeles.
All right, so we should move on and take the next question. This one comes from Mihua Steger.
I've been meditating on this idea of communication, and was provoked by one of your articles in a 1979 campaigner called The Principles of Composition. And so I discovered that there's an integral part, ingredient that I could definitely add to my hot pot of ways of communicating, and that is humor. And this idea of the elements of surprise that you mentioned. I mean, I have a sense of musical humor through playing Beethoven and Mozart. But I also know how powerful it can be, how humor can be, through a deliberate cognitive process. I mean, we get it every day from Phil and Harley. So I was wondering how we actually develop this ability, this deliberate ability of elements of surprise, and how we can actually go about uplifting the morale of our society through cognitive humor. And I have a request. I was wondering if you could recite the third act soliloquy from Hamlet.
I do that only impromptu when not prompted. When it comes out of me automatically. Don't worry about that. It does at times. Otherwise, it doesn't work. I'm not a professional actor, but it just comes out of me right sometimes. Now, the thing is, take a simple song as an example. Take Mozart. We had a discussion this recently, so it's fresh in mind about seeing some people have problems with this. About Am Chloe by Mozart. Now, it's a very silly little song, essentially. But the whole point of the thing hangs on one thing. You have this amorous fellow who's adoring his object of his amour. And it gets to a point, it says, I will love you until death. 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 Oh, change the subject. And back to I will ich liebe dich forever. So that's an example of it, is that it comes in irony that words have... the language cannot be understood from a dictionary. The social use of language involves all the deeper meanings, which are ironical meanings buried in the use of the language. Every idea is an irony. No ideas are literal ideas. If they're literal, they're not ideas. It's an irony. Like this thing about death. I'm Chloe. Death. The guy is a silly guy making a silly song. And why would Mozart set this thing? Because Mozart has a very peculiar kind of humor, sense of humor, a very good one, an excellent, very active one. He's extremely humorous. But this idea that someone says, I will love you until death, and then is appalled by the fact they've used the word death in connection with love. So that, and then he makes this musical setting of this. These kinds of things are rich in language, where languages have a double connotation. I will love you till death, as long as I live. but I will love you until death. It's a different meaning. And so that's, it's on these, on the basis of irony, that words have double meanings, or phrases have double meanings, or triple meanings, because they refer to something which is invisible. Look at just one example. I'm afraid of going too long with these things, but at the same time, I'm also afraid of not giving an adequate answer, giving a fast one where an adequate one were required. This simple thing, which is the basis of most of our educational work in the youth movement, which is why I introduced this question of the Gauss 1799 fundamental theorem of algebra, which is the first time he addresses that, which he attacks specifically the empiricists Euler and Lagrange, most notably. The problem in science, physical science, in the problem of mathematics, is idiots today think you can explain everything statistically. What we, every principle we know, every universal physical principle that's proven, is something we cannot detect with our senses. It's something which exists, which is efficient, like gravity. You cannot find gravity with your senses. You could feel the effects of gravity, but gravity itself, the gentleman chooses not to expose himself. He acts upon you, but he doesn't expose his identity to you. You have to discover it. And so all important ideas, human ideas, and only human beings can do this, are like these principles of science, physical science, we discover by hypothesis, by experiment. None of these things refer to a nameable object of the senses. Now, in language, the idiot will say, that's why the grammarian's funeral is such a sad case, because when a grammarian dies, no ideas die with him. Because all ideas lie outside the explicit. Like gravitation, they lie outside the explicit sense of sense perception. The same thing is true with all classical art. A sense of irony, a presence, an eeriness, something there. I can't quite grasp it. I can sense something there. And all important communication is of that nature. And it all involves passion. It involves all the qualities of passion, of surprise, of the sense of something eerie, something there. It's like making a whole work and finding in a whole work, a whole long form, a whole exposition, that if you take the entire exposition from beginning to end and pause and start to think about it from the beginning and then pause at the end and reflect upon it, you may find there's one idea which is not found explicitly in any part of the whole exposition, but which is the meaning of the whole exposition. This is, for example, I've often cited the cases of the Beethoven Opus 131 or 132 as a case. 131 does state something approximating an idea in the center, but the 131 is a continuous process of development. You pause at the beginning, you pause at the end. But there's one idea there. You cannot locate it as a meaning symbolically in any part of the composition. But it's one of the greatest compositions ever written, with one idea. And therefore, it's developing a sense of this, of looking at the fact that reality for human beings lies outside the senses. We use the senses with our minds to discover, by tricks, to discover what that hiding object is out there. We smoke it out, we find it, we lay our hands on it, we make it dance for us. Now we know it, but we still don't see it. We don't touch it with our senses. We touch it with the mind. And that quality of sensibility, which many people are denied, people do not know what an idea is. So they may have ideas, but they don't know what an idea is. Anyway, so I could go on for like this. We want to lecture for about 5 hours on this subject.
All right, and the next question now comes from Michael.
Which Michael?
It doesn't say. It comes from Michael Steger.
Ellen, I've been thinking about this question for a while, and it's in regards to how music orders the mind.
I'll try to be direct as possible. Did Beethoven's later compositions influence your development of the shock front principle? And how does this principle apply to the human mind in creative discovery, as well as free will? Thank you.
It was another aspect of the same question I've just presented. There's this fellow, Herbart, who is a famous educator and philosopher, who was a protege of Wilhelm von Humboldt in the educational system, which was tucked away for a good part of his career in the remote area of Königsberg, where, which had been polluted for some time by the famous or infamous Immanuel Kant. And he was famous for his attacks on Kant and Kantian philosophy and its degradation and all the other pollution that goes with it. And he gave a series of lectures in the 1840s in Göttingen at the termination of his career, which were attended by a young student at mathematics at the university, Bernhard Riemann. And Riemann made some notations on this at a later point, which I encountered as a part of the Riemann collected works, which were included in the edition by the famous Riemann collected works edition later on, and in connection with my work. And so this aspect, Riemann's appreciation of this importance of Herbart's groping with the idea of the definite idea, the Geistesmasse, lying outside the domain of the visual or the sensible, that this idea was very important to me. And in a sense, this coincided with things I was doing at the same time. And this, the idea that the ideas which exist outside the sensible are not statistical phantoms. If they're real, they're definite ideas, as definite as any other idea. The act of discovery, for example, the act of discovery of a universal physical principle gives us the identity of a principle. It's a universal physical principle. It has an identity. It's a mental object with a specific identity. Your discovery of that, if you actually discovered it, rather than just repeating it from a textbook or some experimental demonstration, your discovery of gravitation, the way Kepler discovered it, is now a definite object in your mind, as definite in your mind as any object of the senses, but it's of a different nature. And this is what is treated by the use of the term Geistesmasse by Herbart and these lectures which Riemann commented. And this, to me, was extremely important. It crystallized a lot of things about a lot of music and a lot of other things all at the same time, and gave me an insight as to why Beethoven, and this coincided with my reflections on the work of, say, the conducting of Wilhelm Furtwängler, which is absolutely remarkable. Furtwängler would say he was conducting in describing his method of conducting as playing between the notes, conducting between the notes. In other words, a person who plays the score as written is an idiot. A person who plays the notes is an idiot. You don't play different notes, but playing the notes is an idiot, because you have to play what is in between the notes. The reality of any classical composition, like a Greek sculpture, a classical Greek sculpture, lies in something in between. It's definite, it communicates, it's as definite as the idea of a physical discovery of universal physical principle, but it does not lie within the expression. The great conductor recognizes this. For example, how does the conductor function? Any great performer, classical performer, musical performer, do the same thing. The first thing he does is what? Nothing. He does absolutely nothing. He pauses until the audience accepts the pause. Then he introduces a change of state, and he establishes his performance in the imagination. Furtwängler, for example, used to do this kind of thing. He'd rehearse where there was an attack required for passage. He would rehearse this thoroughly with the orchestra. Huh? And they would thoroughly rehearse. This was at that time the best orchestra in the world, the most capable. And then when he came out to conduct, he would sit there with his baton, pausing. They're waiting. They're waiting for the signal. Many surprises. And he gets the effect he wants. So he gets. So the trick in all art is to transfer the concentration of the mind from the bare stage of the sense perception to the stage of the imagination, like the classical Greek stage, where the characters of classical Greek tragedy come alive in the mind of the audience. I mean, a typical Greek audience sitting in this hemispherical kind of seating arrangement, out there watching two guys playing with masks. And suddenly, under these conditions, the characters depicted by the masks come alive in the mind of the spectators. They're enraptured in the drama. So they're now living in the imagination. They come, the thing ends, and they pause. They do nothing. Because now you're in the transition from the sensible to the ideal, back to the sensible. The object is to encircle it, that one conception, that one process of development, as a definite idea in the mind of the audience. This can be demonstrated easily with, say, with Schiller's dramas, how this works, how this is accomplished. In Shakespeare, you can induce the same thing in a different way. The concept of the sublime in Schiller is unique in drama in this respect. But it's the same thing. It's always this principle of trying to communicate to people the ideas, like ideas of scientific physical principles, or the idea of humanity. For example, what's the difference between man and an ape? Are you going to give me a description, or do you know man as distinct from an ape? What's your concept of man as different than an ape? Identify the idea so that you're never confused about the difference between a beast and a man. That's lacking. And the function of great art is to enable us to communicate those kinds of ideas by giving us the rehearsal exercises, which are all related to something to do with history, the history of a culture. But at the same time, to teach us, to educate our capabilities to communicate with one another in the same way we've been taught by these great composers of art of the past.
All right. Well, before we go on, I should make some remarks. I noticed there are a lot of younger people, but also a number of older people. And some of the older people may think to themselves, well, you know, why are the young people attracted right now to an 81-year-old man? Well, the reason for that being is right now it is the case that the younger generation are considered as a no-future generation. And what is clear, what Mr. LaRouche has expressed, is that we are facing a threat. During his speech, he'd made very clear that we're facing a threat of fascism all over the world. And so what you see happening, not only in the United States, but also in Mexico, in South America, and in Europe, is a development of a youth movement created by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche to take on this fascist network, but not only to bring, well, not only to defeat this fascist network, but also to create a renaissance. I mean, that's the most important thing behind this youth movement. And so what we've been doing in the last number of years is that we've been rallying, organizing every single day, freaking out the legislators in Sacramento, in Washington, D.C., to the point where they recognize that it's either LaRouche or nothing. So now what we need from everybody in this room is to make the biggest contribution you can to the LaRouche in 2004 campaign. We will win, and contribute to the youth movement, pick up some extra literature, and come on organizing with us. So now to go on to the next question, this comes from Kazim.
My question is about something that always makes me wonder, that what does Mr. Dick Cheney stand to gain from this potent impulse of inflicting a war against Islam? Much of that is underway right now, more than 1 billion Muslims in this world, wherever they live, they are already living in misery. What would he gain from inflicting more gloom on these people? Thank you, sir.
Well, Cheney is not a man who despises gain, obviously. But his character is not located in gain. It's not greed. Don't try to find greed. See, the point is there is in the world, there is the existence of evil. And that's different than greed. Corruption is beyond corruption. Take the case of Adolf Hitler. Or take the case of Freddy or Jason from the Friday the 13th. There is a type of personality which is well known to art. It's well known, it's a type of personality associated with the image of the Dionysius of the Phrygian cult, which is referred to by Nietzsche. You read the writings of the Senecas, the group of Cagliostro and Mesmer and Joseph de Maistre, who's the most voluble on this. The conception which permeates syndicism from its emergence as Martinism, as a cult, is the idea of being a beast man. The perfect man is a beast man who will commit such crimes as no one else would dream of doing or think possible. It would astonish mankind by his criminality, his cruelty, his beastliness, his satanic quality. That people admire him. Oh, Satan, we admire you. We love you. We will do what you do. What do you want of us? We will try to be your disciples and follow you. That is the principle of this kind of thing which we call sometimes fascism. Fascism is who is also the same disposition. The idea of evil for the pleasure of doing what you regard as evil. And that's what the problem is. It is not desire for gain. Cheney is an intrinsically evil person. If he were less unintelligent, he would be absolutely satanic. But he's only a thug for Satan, you know. This is the character. Well, to understand some things in history, to understand some events, like what happened to the Jews in Poland and Germany, how is such a monstrous thing possible? Just think for a moment about gain. The liberation of the Jew in Europe was essentially accomplished through the influence of Moses Mendelssohn, who emerges, is this poor Jew from Dessau, who goes into Berlin, he's a hunchback, he's a genius. He learns languages, he studies under one of the sons of Bach, music, and so forth and so on. He's a genius. He designed the school at which Scharnhorst was trained as a military officer, the military school. The man's a genius. Through the influence of a group of people around him, the struggle for political identity in Europe of the Jew occurred. It occurred in Austria under Joseph II, when he was freed of his terrible mother. And a great impulse, he did that. But it spread throughout Europe. Now think of the effect of this, and look at Germany from the time of Moses Mendelssohn, look backward from Hitler's time to then, and say, now what's going on here? What was the role of the Jew in Germany? Once liberated, suddenly a class of people who had been itinerant beggars, virtually without the right to live, going from place to place with marginal existence, suddenly produced generations of artists, scientists, doctors, whatnot, writers. They proliferated under the influence of the education which spread through the influence of Moses Mendelssohn, both as in the Jewish community and also in the classical humanist community, which developed around this guy, Kestner, Lessing, and Mendelssohn, and so forth, in the latter part of the 18th century in Germany, and spread all over the world. This is what gave us the United States, was the influence of this circle upon Benjamin Franklin. These people were dedicated to creating a nation in North America, to be a tool for creating republics around the world. Now look at Germany as a result of that. What happened to Germany as a result of the liberation of the Jew, the political liberation of the Jew? Think of the contributions. Now why would any German with good sense want to do anything about the German Jews? Like that, why? There's no gain in it. There's no motive for it, except an evil one. What Hitler was aiming to do, and he's explicit on this, and others are explicit. If you read Heidegger, if you read the others, read between the lines, you know what these guys are. Read Wagner on the subject of the Jew, and you understand this thing perfectly. Their plan was to obliterate entire sections of the human population in the name of what was called eugenics. Their aim was to astonish mankind with acts of such monstrous evil that human beings would fall on their knees and embrace the feet of the monster and try to imitate him. This is what you have. You have this in the U.S. today. You have this kind of impulse. This is what Cheney represents. Look, preventive nuclear warfare. Bertrand Russell. Preventive nuclear warfare. Remember, Bertrand Russell was the author of Preventive Nuclear Warfare. He, together with H.G. Wells, concocted this phantom that through terrible weapons, we shall so fright the people, they will subject to tyranny and love it and imitate the tyrant in their seeking to do crimes to which please him for the sake of world government under an ideal society. And for this, Bertrand Russell caused the development of nuclear weapons, personally, not Einstein. Roosevelt never received the Einstein letter. It's in his library, but he's never received it. We checked. Okay. Bertrand Russell said and laid down the doctrine, the use of nuclear weapons as a weapon so terrible that mankind will submit to the kind of utopia that Wells and Russell demanded rather than face these terrible weapons. What Cheney has done is simply revive this. This is called the Revolution of Military Affairs, which was adopted during the 1940s, not the last decade. And this is the policy. To use nuclear weapons to terrify people, to kill, exterminate entire sections of populations by various means, to terrify the human race into submission. You're not dealing with unnice people. You're not dealing with a neighborhood thug, though he may have some of this in him. You're dealing with a truly satanic quality. When I said the Satan, the children of Satan, I meant Satan. I meant Satan in precisely this sense. I was not using some symbolism, some euphemism. This is what it is. And if the human race cannot defend itself against Satanism, it will pay the price of not dealing with Hitler when he could have been dealt with. Only something worse, with nuclear weapons. Therefore, we have to have a clear conception. It is not gain. Yes, he's a thief, among his other qualities. But he shouldn't be in government. He should be out now. And we have the evidence sufficient for an impeachment charge against Cheney, which would get him out immediately. He would be out already if the leadership of the Democratic National Committee was not corrupt.
All right, this next question comes, excuse me if I mispronounce your name, Xiang Don Ren, who is, I assume, the president of the North America Shenzhen Youth Association.
Good evening, everyone. Yeah, my name is Xiang Zhongren. I'm from China. I'm an international student here. And I hope Mr. here can understand what's the question I'm asking. And first, I want to say, and the recall destroyed the good image of democracy system of American in my mind. And second, I want to say, Mr.
LaRouche.
Yeah, LaRouche, as I know, is a famous economist. So I want to ask, as I know, and Bush administration want to recover the economic by or depend on tax reduction copied from Reagan administration. And so my question is, do you think it will work today, and the tax reduction will help the American economic recover? Thanks.
It's a tax problem. You've got inequity in taxation. For example, Kemp Roth. Right? Now, compare the Kemp Roth bill on so-called tax reform, and compare that with the Kennedy Tax Investment Credit, Investment Tax Credit Program. Under the Kennedy philosophy, which is a good one, he has some good advisors, among other things there, is that if a private entrepreneur who earns a profit or has capital, rather than dispersing that capital for consumption or investing it in a stock market or some other foolish thing like that, invests it in buying machinery and so forth for his firm in order to make the firm better, to produce a better product and so forth, then what this fellow has done, this entrepreneur, has created a benefit for the entire nation by contributing his money as credit into his enterprise in ways which make it unnecessary for the government to come in and do the same thing for him. So therefore, since this fellow is doing something for the government, in for society, which is useful economically, why shouldn't he have a lower tax benefit? We'd like more of his type around. Besides, he's making a contribution which justifies it. Whereas if the fellow goes is a spendthrift and wants to go out and get a lot of money quick and spend it on foolish things like trying to find a third sex or something like that to alleviate his boredom, then this fellow should probably be taxed at a very high rate. Because his money is only dangerous to him in his own hands. He'll probably spend it for drugs or some other foolish kind of thing. Now, on the other side, the inequities. Think of the inequities. First of all, the tax exemption on the lower end of the income scale. This is where the cruelty occurs. So we should shift the tax burden. Those entrepreneurs who are doing a useful job for society should have the benefit of investment tax credit protection, because they're doing something for society, and that should be acknowledged. And the more of them, the better they do that job, the better for all of us. It's our function to try to promote investment in the private sector in that way, to that purpose. If somebody is simply spending the money all over the place in some undesirable, unpleasant way, especially like Kemp Roth proposes, then no. What has happened now is we have, as a result of Kemp Roth and similar kinds of changes and deregulation, we've created a vast financial bubble with amount of debt, especially in the area of financial derivatives, which could never be paid. The debts of the world today will never be paid. They can never be paid, because the rate at which we are generating income, which might be taxable or seizable otherwise, is far less than the rate at which these financial derivatives and other things are increasing. So the payment of debt could never catch up with the growth of debt. This is largely, to some degree, the benefit of Alan Greenspan, who has poured more money in with the aid of electronic printing presses, monetary emission, than has ever been known in the past of the human race. You don't print money anymore, you emit it electronically. And that's what the monetary aggregate is, which is going into the vast real estate bubbles and so forth. So therefore, what we've done is by encouraging a lower tax rate, as Kemp Ross specified, on things which are parasitical, we have encouraged the development of a parasite. Our economy, our financial economy, is a big parasite sucking the blood out of the physical economy. The desirable thing is that the economy be so managed and money so managed that those things which are useful to society should be encouraged. And we should, especially in economy, we should recognize those things which are useful. We should also recognize our general obligation to the general welfare and to posterity. This is our law. We can do it. This is not impossible. We can do it. If we educate people properly, if we invest in infrastructure properly, if we give people the opportunities, we can increase the rate of physical growth to meet economic needs and progress far above any tax burden problem. We have to rearrange the furniture and burn some of it. We're going to have to do it. When the time comes and the crunch will come soon, someone, if this nation is to survive, someone in government must say, we are going to apply the Constitution. We're going to meet the obligations of the general welfare for the continued functioning of society and its growth. And if people come in with large financial claims, they go to the end of the line. And if they're questionable, we simply have to cancel it, because we cannot pay all these debts. The world cannot pay all these debts, ever. So if we're going to have a financial system, we're going to have to cancel a lot of it. We're going to have to meet in the short term the thing, essential needs, and restructure the things so that our tax structure, our way of running things, is equitable in terms of the general welfare principle, and also wise, not only equitable, but wise. It must be prudent. We must encourage those things which are beneficial for society. We must hope that individuals will solve problems so that government will not have to solve these problems. Like the firm that invests in improving a product is taking a problem away from government by solving a problem in society for general use. So prudence means foster those things which are useful and things that are not fostered.
Second question is, recall and attack on the U.S. election system?
Yes, it is. Recall, look, what happens on recall? On recall, what have they said their intention is? And if you know what Brother Bustamante's connections are to Joe Lieberman, among other things, under those conditions, what these guys are going to do is exactly what has been threatened. You think you've had deregulation now in California? How would you like another round under Warren Buffett, George Shultz and company, Chan Cheney? What would you like, another round of that? You want everything deregulated, more radical, more extreme deregulation, like the idiot George Bush proposed? George Bush told the governor of California, the problem here is not deregulation, you haven't done enough of it. We've given you all the poison and you haven't died yet.
All right, this next question comes from Nasser Motamedi.
I appreciating your humanistic feelings and your endeavor in this line. I know you are you know all about economics. I know little bit also about economics. I have a question on world economic order. That is, from my observation and also from my studies, during last 50 years, this country and other rich countries, their per capita income from something like about $2,000 have reached to something about $35,000, which is 17, at least more than 17 times increase. If you take 13, 14 part of it as inflation, the per capita income in this country and the richer countries have at least during last 50 years have been tripled. This is my guess, my approach and thought. Now, during next 50 years and 100 years, which is not very far away, the per capita income of the rich countries must reach 100 and $300,000 dollars with the present buying power of dollar. Is this the kind of income humanity needs for food, shelter, and clothing? Is this consumptive economic, which is widening the gap between the rich and poor in this society of the world, which over 800 million don't have even enough food and 80 million people are dying from hunger? Is this what, how's your thought about this? How can we, what can we do to make it a little more safer? Or if it is safe and doesn't, we don't have to worry about it. Thank you very much.
First of all, the two things to look at. Number one is since 1977, in physical terms, the income of the lower 80% of family income brackets in the United States has been collapsing at an accelerating rate. So the United States is not a rich country. The United States is a very poor country. It's a very depleted country. Now that poses the problem. There's the paradox. What you had is the emphasis on the one side is the emphasis on money as money. Now, what do you have in the world? We used to have the American system, as specified by Hamilton, in which the in accord with the intent of our Constitution. We allow no central banking system in the United States. That is, no independent central banking system. We have, by courtesy of Edward VII, the once King of England, through his agent Adam Schiff, Jacob Schiff in New York City, we have the Federal Reserve System, which is a federally chartered, quasi-independent central banking system. Europe is dominated by a form of defective form of government, at best, the Anglo-Dutch liberal parliamentary model, in which the third element of government is the independent central banking system, which is the most powerful of them all. So now what you have a world which is controlled by money, per se, and a special banking financier interest which controls money is controlling money, manipulating it to increase money without increasing production. Why are people starving? The principal reason is we're not producing the food. The policy has been since 1974, as under Kissinger's draft policy, SM 200, is to kill the population of the world, to reduce it. The policy of genocide in Africa is a deliberate policy of the U.S. government to lower the to lower the population in Africa so they will not, as Kissinger argues, use up the raw materials of the Southern African Shield. If they increase their population or even maintain their population, they will consume these natural resources, which we in the United States need for our future. Therefore, we must kill these people to get rid of them. We must not allow them to develop because they'll use more of the natural resources. Therefore, kill them or induce them to kill one another, to kill themselves. We could produce enough food. We have the technology to produce enough food to meet the world needs. We're not allowed to do it. The United States could increase its food production greatly. We've destroyed the American farmer. Not a good idea. So the problem here is we have to look at it from two standpoints. Money is an idiot. Yeah? Understand that it's an idiot. It has no intrinsic value. It has a fictitious value which can be assigned to it by law, by process. That is, we set up systems to regulate the relationship between physical values and monetary values. to regulate the way money is issued and flows so that the value of the market basket of physical consumption does not increase in absolute price. So therefore, if you have that balance, you don't have a problem. With that, you maintain that balance by regulation, you maintain it by tax policy of taxing some things which are useful, tax other things which are not useful at a higher rate, by credit policies, by regulating credit, by regulating financial markets, by regulating stock markets, by state regulation, by federal regulation. Under these conditions, if the public policy is made by a sovereign people through its representative institutions of government to the purpose of meeting human need, we have presently the means to do so. The problem is we have a powerful interest, a financier interest, which is a relic of ancient times, which sits on our back like a parasite and says, you must submit to us. We have the right to control money. We have the right to freely use that money to increase money. We have the right to loot your firm, to loot your country, do whatever we want to do for the sake of money. We can regulate prices of currencies. We can regulate flows of currency, flows of value. So we have to restore responsibility to government to protect the people. A classic example is the farmer. Now, the typical farmer has a limited number of acreage, which is generally a few hundred acres for an interfamily farm under modern technology. He produces a very high quality of product, which depends upon a lot of steel, a lot of other things that go into that, to be able to produce high quality product. These fellows were very reliable. We put them almost out of existence in the United States since about 1977. We had the technology. Other parts of the world have food technologies, but it takes investment in that. So our policies should be essentially physical policies related to the needs of the world and its people. Then we use the money system and regulate the money system so that its behavior corresponds. And therefore, that means, for example, for me, I say go back to the Roosevelt idea of the post-war system. We have a fixed exchange rate, which is going to be difficult to pull together, but we can do it. It should probably be gold reserve based. We're probably talking about $1,200 an ounce, for troy ounce for gold at that kind of situation. We have to do something like that. We have to accept protectionist agreements among nations to regulate flows, because the purpose has to be not how the money score comes out. The purpose has to be the physical effect. As in Africa, the question of U.S. policy toward Africa has to be the physical effect experienced by the Africans. For example, our policy for the United States has to be the physical effect upon our people and their future development. And we should not worship money. Money is simply something which should be issued by government. Its value should be regulated by government so that you can count on it. We should all have, take regulated utilities. We used to have, under Roosevelt precedence, we had on various states, state and federal utilities. On the state level, you could invest savings in public utilities. Because of the regulations, these were generally the most reliable places for people who did not have the means to risk a lot of investment to put it in safely for their security, for their future, and so forth. We had these. We destroyed it. This was an example of the regulation of money and the regulation of the flow of money in ways where public policy and private policy come to a common agreement for an end result, which is essentially a physical end result. Then the problem is manageable. The problem is now we're living in this fantasy world of it's what happened in the 14th century. When you have these two, Biche and Mouche, these two representatives of the House of Barby, who were leading among the so-called Lombard bankers in imposing a pyramid of debt not too dissimilar from what's happening to the world today. And this pyramid of debt, on the basis of the repudiation of the debt of England by the monarch at that time, set forth a chain reaction where the entire system of Europe collapsed. And the size of the population was reduced by one-third, and half the parishes of Europe vanished in the greatest plague and dark age of that period. We are now in such a situation. We should have learned the lesson from that system, the Venetian system of that period, never to allow that to happen. But it's happened. And it now runs in the nice name of Engel-Gotch liberal parliamentary system. And poor as our country is, I'm glad we have our constitution. Because if we go back to it, we won't make those kinds of mistakes.
Hello. Hey, Freddie, do you care if I'm going to interrupt here quick? There's a name that's not on your list. Nick Walsh wanted to ask a question, and he's on security, so he couldn't come up to the mic. And since it's on one of my favorite historical individuals, I think it's appropriate that it's okay to budge. And that is that, what is the importance of Schiller's aesthetical letters to what we're doing?
The aesthetical letters came out of a problem which Schiller recognized in correspondence with a friend of his on the problem posed by Kant. The young generation that he was dealing with were infected with the idea of Kant's writings as a great teaching of morality. And Schiller objected in reaction and wrote this series of aesthetical letters on that and related promptings to people like Wilhelm von Humboldt and so forth, this whole group, which he educated on this issue. What is rotten and evil about Immanuel Kant? So this raised all these questions, and the essence of Schiller is two things to understand. Number one, Schiller was trained as a physician under not favorable conditions, military conditions, and had difficult conditions as a playwright. But he devoted himself, as he explains, to the use of drama as the method of educating people in history. He was a very meticulous and thorough historian. His Jena lectures on the subject are a sort of a culmination of his work in that direction. That Schiller's dramas are used to convey the principles of history and statecraft to people, to produce dramas which take people who are not truly citizens, but only subjects, into a theater and have the people sit there, transported by in the domain of the imagination by a real classical tragedy. So they, from their seat, are suddenly looking down upon leading figures of the society depicted in the tragedy. And they are passing judgment on kings and whatnot, looking from their seats in the theater. And because they understand this, aided by great drama, they go out of the theater, no longer little people saying, oh, I'm only little me. They also think of themselves as having partaking of the quality of being able to judge what policies of society at the highest level are required and to be avoided in life. The other aspect of Schiller, which is the idea of the sublime. Schiller was the one who made the concept of the sublime or the Erhabene explicit. And that's simply the case, for example, of Jeanne d'Arc, and he portrays it in his drama. It's historically precise for the purpose it's done. That was Jeanne d'Arc. Jeanne d'Arc was determined to save France, and she did. But she did it in point of fact, at a point that her being burned alive was at stake. She could have escaped being burned alive if she had agreed to compromise her mission. She refused to compromise her mission. She was burned alive by the Inquisition. The shock of this incident inspired France to free itself from this Anjou monstrosity and to establish at a later point, under the influence of Jean's work, to establish France as the first modern nation state. That is a nation state in which the monarch was subject to serving the general interest, the common general welfare of the whole population, the first so-called modern commonwealth. The second was, based on the same model, was Henry VII's England. And so Schiller understood in this point was that the individual faced with an impossible situation, as Jean was sometimes to horrible effect, will rise to the sublime because she realizes that her immortal self and its mission is more important to her than her mortality. She does not seek to die. No person seeks suicide for a moral purpose. But because she was put her life on the line for humanity, because by doing so, she consummated the meaning of her life. And this concept of the sublime, it applies to that kind of situation and to other situations, where you're faced with a situation whereby all the rules of so-called self-interest and so forth, as you understand them, you're going to do the wrong thing. You're faced with an existential crisis. You have to put your life personally on the line at that moment. You have to make that decision. You have to see the way in which you have to act to solve the problem, not to try to solve your little problem, but to solve the larger problem which you find confronting you. It's like the case of true heroism, not folly, foolishness, but true heroism in battle, where someone acts as if by instinct to save the situation. The person who acts in a dangerous situation, as if by instinct, to pull a people and lead a people out of a mess is in. And this insight into oneself and all that that implies and all the areas of life which this affects is the significance of Schiller's aesthetic letters. It's not the finished end of it. Some of the later dramas, particularly on this concept, working on this concept of the sublime, are further expression of it. But it's really it's an amazing experience, this aspect of Schiller.
Well, now for the most unpopular part of the night, we're going to have to end the meeting. But there's a lot of work to be done. I think, first of all, we should thank Lynn for his contributions to us here tonight.
Thing I can say, as I say often, and understand my meaning. If you don't understand my meaning, I'm sure there are those who will translate it for you. My advice, admonition, is simply have fun.
And we will have fun because we're going to deliver a knockout punch to Dick Cheney in California. And we're going to do it because as you leave here tonight, every single one of you is going to be committed to the organizing process in the next 27 or so days to get the word out to the rest of the people of California that there is a cure for stupidity. And it's when you begin to think. And if it's hard for them to begin it, then you're going to start that process by getting them to reflect on their own foolishness of even considering to accept this idea of recall and replacing our current governor with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I would encourage everyone to get the literature. We'll have a large contingent of young people out there to make sure you take pamphlets and literature. We're going to have motorcades, rallies. We're going to get out millions of pieces of literature. We're going to need lots of funds to do that. So thank you all for coming tonight, and we've got a lot of work to do.